and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. A Trump-appointed commission says the separation of church and state is not in the Constitution. We hear from Chicago area religious leaders. And it was a time of deep division. No, we're not talking about our current political climate, but about the American Revolution. We revisit our conversation with filmmaker Ken Burns on his recent series. First off tonight, Chicago's top cop, Larry Snelling, says he is retiring from the force effective July 15th. Snelling, a 34-year veteran of the department, was appointed as superintendent in 2023 by Mayor Brandon Johnson. He previously served as head of CPD's Bureau of Counterterrorism. In a statement, Snelling writes, quote, "I am closing out this chapter of my life with a heart full of gratitude for every Chicagoan and every community partner who embraced me during my time at the Chicago Police Department. Thank you does not fully express my appreciation for you, the people of Chicago. I ask that you continue to extend the same warmth and support to every member of the department." Meanwhile, interim superintendent Fred Waller will take Snelling's place as the Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability begins its search process for CPD's next leader. In a statement, Mayor Johnson thanked Snelling and praised him for his service. That extreme heat warning across much of northern Illinois extends through tomorrow night as temperatures today reached up to 95 degrees with the heat index at a toasty 105. The National Weather Service says the heat index tomorrow could get up to 102 degrees with another high of 95. ComEd is asking people to conserve energy as the utility experiences increased demand. It recommends closing shades and curtains, waiting to run the laundry or dishwasher until later, and setting the thermostat 4 degrees higher than normal. The Illinois Department of Transportation is asking residents to keep an eye out for pavement buckling or tire blowouts, which can happen with little warning during periods of prolonged heat and humidity. Meanwhile, volunteers with My Block, My Hood, My City donated 300 box fans and 300 cases of water to elderly and disabled residents who requested their help.
Anytime the city gets overwhelmed by Mother Nature, if there's a heat wave or a snowstorm, our elders have oxygen tanks, or they have walkers, they have neuropathy. They can't get out the house, and so they need our support. It just seems like it's warm weather, but it can turn dangerous real fast. So we have volunteers from all over Chicago. We got 920 requests.
Founder Jamal Cole says because the group received so many requests for assistance, they are still seeking donations. Up next, a look at whether or not the separation of church and state has become an obsolete idea. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
The separation of church and state is, quote, the biggest lie that's been told in America since our founding. That is what the chair of President Trump's Religious Liberty Commission said when the group was formed. Now that commission has issued a 224-page report calling for what amounts to, at the least, blurring the line between religious expression and public life. Composed almost entirely of conservative Christians and a single Orthodox rabbi, the commission signals the direction the Trump White House may be trying to shift the country. Here's committee chair, Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick.
Again, the separation of church and state is not in the Constitution. And from this day forward, if anyone says that to you and they're in public office or serve in any agency in any official capacity, they have to point out exactly where you have violated the Constitution, because you have not. And from this day forward, that phrase should have no power over people of all faiths ever again in America.
So joining us are Josh Weiner, Chief Advocacy Officer at the North American Values Institute, a nonprofit which says it's focused on combating extremism and anti-Semitism in K-12 schools. Reverend Quincy Worthington, pastor at the Highland Park Presbyterian Church. Hassan Ali, an Islamic scholar and founder of the Qiyam Institute, a nonprofit that promotes Islamic values through education. and Rabbi Emeritus Michael Siegel of the Ansha Emet Synagogue in Lakeview. Thanks to all of you for joining us. We appreciate it. So first, I want to get all of your reactions to what we just heard from Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, that the separation of church and state is not in the Constitution. Josh Weiner, let's start with you, please.
Well, I think he's technically correct that that phrasing is not in the Constitution, but the Constitution outlines in the Establishment Clause a two-way street on this. And it is true that Thomas Jefferson did have a speech in the early 1800s about building a wall between church and state, but the interesting caveat around that is the history is that at that point, states actually were allowed to have religions, not the federal government. And that wall was actually referring to in Massachusetts or in Connecticut, they were worried that the federal government would infringe on their ability to have a state religion. And Thomas Jefferson was talking about that wall in that context being to prevent that. Now, in 1947, there was a Supreme Court case that did away with that, and I think that's personally, from my point of view, for the better. But I think it's disingenuous to say that the separation of church and state isn't a important legal argument that we have, and that we should be very considerate to how the Constitution is interpreted relative to it.
Reverend Worthington.
Yeah, I mean, I echo pretty much exactly your sentiments on that. I mean, it was based off of the Virginia Amendment in their Constitution, and it's funny to me how these people are original intents when it comes to supporting things that they're in support of in the Constitution, but the minute original intent doesn't suit their needs, it just goes right out the window.
Hassan.
You know, I totally agree, and I think it's easy to claim that so many things that we're practicing in this country do not exist in the Constitution, but I believe that the genius of the American constitutional system is that it allows every and each citizen who lives in this country to practice their own religion with freedom and dignity, but at the same time prevents the state to advocate or adapt one religion and favor one religion over another religion. And this is very obvious in everyday life we do in America.
Rabbi.
Whether or not the separation of church and state is in the Constitution or not, the fact is we've been living in this country with that separation. And one of the great benefits of that is that the United States of America is the most religious country amongst industrialized countries in the world. And that's because we have allowed in this country religion to flourish privately, not through the state, not through an established religion. And I'm very conscious when we start using terms like bridges, because while we are involved in what I think is a really important conversation to be having as our country celebrates its 250th anniversary, this is a very powerful issue. In 1776, Maryland transitioned from a colony to a state, and it created another constitution that was ratified. And in that constitution, there was a Christian oath that was required. That meant that any non-Christian would not be allowed, because of that oath, to hold public office. Because of that oath, they could not become a lawyer. Because of that oath, they couldn't join the militia. That is another anniversary we should be aware of, and 50 years later, that was rescinded. So 200 years ago, that constitutional piece was rescinded. So this is an important issue.
So I want to get into a little bit more about what the report says because it argues that the principle of separating church and state has at times been used to suppress religious expression in public institutions, from schools and hospitals to the military. Reverend Worthington, where should that line be drawn? How can institutions remain secular while also honoring and protecting individuals' freedoms to express their own religious beliefs?
I think we got to be careful about this. I mean, we already see the Department of Defense taking 200 and different known religions, narrowing it down and saying we're only going to accept 30, right? So I think what we have to do is open up space for people to freely express and practice their religion without inhibiting it. But then we also have to be careful that what we're not doing, I mean, like in this case, it's a matter of students being able to freely express their religion. But then when you bring in teachers and people in power, you run the risk of them trying to enforce or promote a religion onto them. And I think that's where the danger comes from, is allowing people to express their religion without having religion shoved down their throat or forced upon them. And so that's a very nuanced conversation.
So the commission, it's made up, as we said, entirely of Christian commentators, activists, some public officials, except for one Orthodox Jewish rabbi. And many of the examples of the religious discrimination that are detailed in the report are against specifically Christians and Jews. Hassan, do you think this administration and this commission, are they as concerned about discrimination against Muslims and Muslim Americans?
I don't think they are concerned about discrimination about Muslims or even other religions. We're not the only religion who has no representation in this committee. We have a lot of other religions in America, minorities, people who practice their own religions. They have temples, they have places of worship, they have children who go to schools, in the public schools. And I think in order to have even a discussion about something very special like this, something that is fundamental in our community and our society as faith communities, we have to have representation from all the minorities and all of the faith groups, including Muslims, Sikhs, Hindus, and other people, and even also to include people who have no faith, because they live in this country and they have the right to have their own input in making such a policy.
Josh, critics say that the Trump administration has done everything short of an explicit endorsement of Christianity. How do you see it?
I think that they were pretty careful in to a certain respect of really saying that they should allow Bible study in school, I think, or in institutions. I think that they straddled a line that's maybe allowing something. I'll put it this way. We have, and I'm going to use education because this is where, you know, I do my work. We have state education standards in Illinois around culturally responsive education. Our organization is concerned that one of the pillars of culturally responsive education, critical consciousness, is being used to bring a political agenda into classrooms. So when I see that allowance of bringing the Bible in the classrooms, I see that potentially as a mechanism by which teachers could bring their own political or religious views into classrooms, and I think that's a place that I'm concerned about. In particular, in Texas, we see that they've adopted standards that actually list Bible stories and verses in Texas schools, and I worry that certain teachers will take it upon themselves to go beyond teaching Bible as history relative to American history and start teaching Bible as scripture in the classroom. So that's a concern, especially as a Jewish person, to me.
Rabbi Siegel, should the administration have included other folks from other religions in this commission?
Without question. The fact that we're using the King James Bible as the gold standard creates a problem for Catholics. Mm-hmm. Right? It creates problems for Jews. And so what happens when the Bible is made into the established book in the state of Texas for religion? That's the danger. And here I would add one other thing. Children are free to get up in classrooms if they do not want to be part of that conversation. Right? That's part of this as well. Imagine what it would be like for a Hindu or a Sikh or a Jew, or a Muslim child to stand up and look at the teacher and say, I'm not comfortable with this conversation. This is religious coercion in a way that should make all of us feel uncomfortable. And I am not anti-Bible, not for a long shot. I believe in the Bible, and I also believe in its lessons for us. It's how it is administered, where the conversation can take place, where we can express respect for different religious traditions and passages from other holy books.
So you just mentioned something, Josh, you know, because these developments, they're happening at a time when Texas is implementing that new law requiring Bible verses to be read in public schools. The state has already passed a law requiring the Ten Commandments to be displayed in every classroom. Reverend Worthington, you know, do these laws reflect religious liberty or inserting religion where it was not already?
Well, I guess my main concern is what we see here is a promotion of specifically white Christian nationalism and a very narrow definition of what Christianity is, which is one that I tend to find to be the greatest idolatry and heresy of our time and probably the biggest threat to religion. And so I think we need to be very careful and speak out very plainly and clearly on that. And it seems to me that if the government wants to help people practice their faith, they should help us feed the hungry. They should help us honor the immigrant as a precious child of God that they are. They should help us visit those who are in prison. They should practice justice. And I think that would be the better place to start than where they're starting with this.
I mean, you know, we talk about the Ten Commandments being displayed in the classroom, for example. Have the courts not already settled this issue? Anybody? With regard to, like, exactly.
Right.
Hassan, we've got about, go ahead, Josh, sorry, we've got about a minute left.
I think having the Ten Commandments in a classroom could amount to implying that the school actually endorses the Ten Commandments. I do think, though, it's important that we have a real conversation about this country's founding and how woven religion is into that founding. The Declaration of Independence talks about endowed by our Creator, rights for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These are things that do come from Hebraic biblical text. And I think teaching that history is important, but we certainly need to be careful about straying into indoctrinating students with a belief that this is what you should believe or need to believe because the school is telling you so.
All right, well, we're out of time. That's where we'll have to leave it. My thanks to all of you for joining us. Josh Weiner, Reverend Quincy Worthington, Hassan Ali, and Rabbi Michael Siegel. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, filmmaker Ken Burns on his newest film series, The American Revolution. Legendary filmmaker Ken Burns' latest epic production is The American Revolution. The film premiered this past fall on PBS and will run again here on WTTW this Sunday in marathon fashion, starting at 6 a.m. and running until 7 p.m. In November, Burns and one of his co-filmmakers, Sarah Botstein, joined us to talk about it. Here's another look at that conversation, beginning with a clip from episode one.
Long before 13 British colonies made themselves into the United States, the six nations of the Iroquois Confederacy, Seneca, Cayuga, Onondaga, Tuscarora, Oneida, and Mohawk, had created a union of their own that they called the Haudenosaunee, a democracy that had flourished for centuries.
Joining us now with more about this monumental project are filmmakers Ken Burns and Sarah Botstein. Welcome to Chicago Tonight. Glad to have you both here.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
Congrats on this massive project is not quite the word
it's
to cover
it. It's been a long, long time.
I'm sure it has. So as we just heard, you begin with a different confederation of states. Not so much the colonies that we know become the United States, but specifically Native American nations that long predated the American Revolution. How important was it to begin with that context, Ken Burns?
Well, I think, you know, what we're taught in grammar school is that the American Revolution is about taxes and representation. And that's true, but it's also about Native American land. And I thought it was interesting as we learn more and more about it that Benjamin Franklin had himself been inspired by the Haudenosaunee, this Iroquois Confederacy, and their model that had worked for a long time as a model for the United States. And he convened seven of the 13 colonies in Albany, drew a picture of a snake cut into pieces under the dire warning, join or die, and then we just realize maybe that shouldn't be in the body of the film, but maybe at the very beginning, so that we could realize that what the revolution is a world war, a civil war, and a war essentially over the prize of North America. And what is the prize? This land. And that land is already occupied by 13 British colonies, superimposed over the land of Native nations, and to the west are many more Native nations that are extraordinarily complicated groups, each individual, and as different from one another as, say, France is from Belgium. And we wanted to make sure that was understood, that at the heart, that this is about moving into this new space that and is, claiming it for our own.
It is about so much more than many of us really remember. And many people don't fully appreciate, once you get into the war part, right, just how savage that conflict is. Here's a clip discussing the aftermath of the Battle of Bunker Hill in June of 1775.
It's four of the most awful hours of combat in American military history. There are 1,000 British casualties that day. There are 220-some British dead.
40% of the attacking force was killed or injured. 40%. That's a horrendously high casualty rate. It is the highest casualty rate for the British Army until the first day of the Somme in 1916. It is unbelievably bloody.
Sarah Botstein, we hear from one expert who says part of the Revolutionary War or part of the revolutionary history has been sanitized. Mm-hmm. What are we misunderstanding or forgetting about the Revolution?
Well, I think, you know, we forget that the American Revolution is at least two things happening at the same time. One is this huge revolution of ideas and how a government might be structured and who might lead that government and who might be responsible in selecting who rules that government. And the other is a terribly brutal, very complicated, as Ken was just saying, 18th century war. And 18th century war is really terrible and awful and bloody and scary and violent and dark. And in order to really understand our founding story, I think you really have to braid the two together. You have to understand the revolution for this war of ideas and ideals, and then the war that was fought for those ideals and principles to have a run.
Ken, in other conversations, you've talked about democracy being sort of an unintended consequence of the revolution. What do you mean by that?
So the idea is, first of all, there's a quarrel between Englishmen that gets broken out into natural rights. It's the Enlightenment. So they're thinking of arguments about why Britain is wrong, and all of a sudden they're no longer saying, well, you said this and we deserve this, but human beings themselves, by being human beings, deserve that. Natural rights. So Jefferson is going to say all men are created equal while he owns other human beings. The cat is out of the bag. Now human beings are going to have to be equal, even though it takes 89 years to happen in the United States. That's over. So things are beginning to change and morph in the world, and the American Revolution is leading that change of how these ideas are moving. So the assumption of democracy is that these people are going to come together and create a republic. They mean of an elite, almost like the example that kind of we inherit from Greece and to a lesser extent Rome. But the people who are going to fight and die and win this war are so-called ordinary people, and they're going to deserve something. So you can say that democracy is not an object of the American Revolution. It's a consequence of it. And there's a big difference of that, and we are all the beneficiaries of that big difference.
So obviously lots of voices, reenactments, footage over 9 years of work. We hear a number of very familiar celebrity voices. How do you think this series is different from any other documentary you've done?
Well, you know, first of all, and it goes back to what Sarah and you were talking about with the violence. You know, if you've got the photographs, if you've got the newsreels, the violence is proven. But if you've got a painting and somebody's got a bayonet and maybe there's even a little trickle of blood,
250 years
ago. Doesn't feel, they seem different for us. They are very much like us. So I think this is a story about how you tell the real story of the revolution and you get under the surface of it and forget the distance and time. And a lot of it is doing reenactments. A lot of it is asking the finest actors in the world to read off camera. And I think we have a better cast than any film that's ever been made or television series ever that helped bring alive not just the familiar top-down folks, and you get to know Washington a little bit better with more dimension, but dozens, scores of other people that you've never heard of. Sometimes they're teenagers. Sometimes they're Native American. Sometimes they're free or enslaved black people here, or women who are half the population and are central to the success of the revolution and to keeping the resistance alive, whose stories aren't told, but also all the other players in this global struggle. The French, the Dutch, the Spanish, the English, all of their soldiers, all of their kings, all of their ministers. And so what you do is, by having all of these different voices, you give a sense that this is what really took place. And instead of putting your thumb on one side or the other, you're an umpire calling balls and strikes, then everybody's got their play. Everybody understands their role in it, and you can make it the complex, I think, most interesting story we've ever tried to tell.
And that's our show for this Wednesday night. You can stream Chicago Tonight on our WTTW YouTube channel every evening and catch up on any programs you may have missed. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that contributes to public safety policy and guidelines.